Feels good to be connected. We're in different places, and yet as we practice together, I'm aware of kind of the merit we generate together, right? To have these friends on the journey, these Kalyanamitta, people you practice with, aligned with. We're all trying to end suffering for ourselves and others. And so I just really am very grateful. Sometimes in the dark moments, it is the knowledge and like the sensation of these sanghas that help me to sustain, right? Like when things get difficult, I'm like, oh, people are practicing with me. People want freedom for everyone like I want. People want to end the suffering for everyone. So I mean it sincerely. Thank you for your practice. So please take care of yourself if you need water or a bathroom break. But I'm going to start kind of talking about what came to me this morning. I mentioned earlier that I was like, oh, I had my talk planned. It was equanimity and it was, practicing in difficult times. And then I had this wonderful conversation with a friend, as we do. And this person is a teacher and practitioner, and he helped me really see some things. So I want to start with just kind of this question, which I love to ask people, is like, why do you practice? It doesn't often arise sometimes, but like, what's underneath it? You probably had quite a day and you showed up here to be in this beautiful sangha, and what is the benefit, for yourself and for others of your practice? It's a commitment. Time, resources, energy, so you've chosen. And I just wonder if you are clear on kind of like what is the practice bringing for you and to what do you devote yourself? I mentioned earlier that I came through the doorway of suffering, and as I noticed these practices within the Dharma, I started to feel less suffering, and that was very appealing to me. And then I started to go on a deeper level and understand that my practice and understanding these concepts and the teachings of the Dharma were actually very liberatory, not just for my suffering, but like in my spirit. And so, we cultivate these conditions through our practice. Tonight we were in silent meditation. I invited you to kind of focus and concentrate, and this is a wonderful foundational tool to the practice, especially for insight meditation. It's like, can we become aware of our attention, and can we move it? Right? If you are focused on your breath while the cars are zooming by, or while my husband's making dinner and clanking in the kitchen, can you hold your attention on the breath or in the body? It's a very powerful tool. And so we also cultivate these conditions, the Buddha nature that is within us all, right? We take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. But we take refuge in the Buddha nature that exists within each of us. This capacity for compassion, for equanimity, and for joy, and for metta and loving kindness, right? What are the ways in which we invite and create those conditions in our lives? We practice. So these are some of the thoughts that I have as I, talk on this journey. This mindful awareness and concentration practice. As I began my studies, I was quite good at being still, but my mind was racing constantly. I don't know if you can relate, but right, this monkey mind, and it's like, oh, it actually does take some practice to hold the attention and sustain it. And it's not ever in this like prescriptive controlling way, but to allow the thoughts to come and pass without following them, to not attach to the fact that I'm worried about what's coming tomorrow or what I didn't do today. I mean, this was the practice. And so I wonder, as you devote yourself to this practice and you build sangha, how are you developing your practice? How is it impacting and changing? How are we developing these benevolent states, right? The Brahma Viharas, as they're often described, the divine abodes, or these practices that I'd like to just take a minute to kind of talk about is, we talk about compassion. When we are our best selves and when we are grounded and centered, it can be easier to find compassion for others and for ourselves. In a world that is very quick moving, there's lots of things pulling our attention. We are like inundated with more media, more challenge. I mean, the news is 24-hour cycles now, and it's not like it used to be. So we're literally, our attention is pulled consistently. And so to be able to kind of steer our own ship of our mind is a really wonderful tool. How do we know when it's time to steer away from, the anxiety and the challenge of kind of fast-moving news? How can you cultivate compassion for yourself? There's a direct correlation between the compassion we have for ourselves and what we can offer others. Sometimes it's easier to offer compassion to others than ourselves, and it's worth exploring. And our mindful awareness can be supportive of that practice. We did a brief practice on metta of loving kindness. How many folks have practice or metta or have tried it? Or yeah, a couple of us. Yeah, there's this wonderful teaching that Sharon Salzberg does. She's made an entire, career talking about metta. There's this wonderful thing that I sat with her once, and she said, how are you generating the sensation of loving kindness before you send it out? Right, tonight I offered some phrases. May you feel joy and ease. May you feel safe and protected. May you feel healthy and strong. But it's actually about like, what are the words that land for you? When I first started practicing metta, when Sharon's like, cultivate the sensation. And I used to think, I love the sensation of like cool water on a hot day. I love drinking, really cool water. And I was like, oh, like, may I feel refreshed, like cold water on a hot day. Or like the sensation of my little nieces and nephews kind of laughing, right? It's like, how do you beat that? You can't. So I was like, oh, like, may I feel the joy of like kids laughing. And so whatever the words are, to cultivate this loving kindness sensation in your heart. And then as you send it out, right, it has this beautiful impact. And it does. It does start to reduce my suffering. It does start to create more capacity for compassion. It's loving kindness, they're related. And then this mudita, this practice of joy, again, the when we slow down to practice and we're able to more clearly kind of see what's happening in our mind, we can notice. Like, if you asked you or invited you to kind of comb through your morning, what were the things in this morning that, maybe brought you joy? Right? If I invited you in this moment to consider, the space that you're in and the physical space and the emotional space, or anybody that's in the building with you, how could you bring to your mind and hold your attention to joy? Oh, there's going to be this dinner eventually. I'm going to love that. My husband's a great cook. Or like, in spite of the suffering that I have from difficult conversations today, there is also joy. So this practice isn't just to be isolated here, it's actually to cultivate these conditions, these benevolent states is our practice. And then this practice of equanimity, which I find very useful, it's this can you be buoyed in all these conditions, right? We understand that there's suffering in all of our lives, and the degree of suffering shifts and change. There's this ephemeral nature of kind of how we navigate. And I like to think of the equanimity practice as the ability to kind of like, yeah, we rock, but we don't sway all the way in either direction, right? Can we notice pleasant without becoming attached? Oh, I really like that person, and I had such a good time with them, without attaching to them so tightly that we experience suffering with their not present. And then simultaneously, this idea that as we experience suffering, I didn't get that job, and like, oh, I really wanted it, and why didn't I get the job? Like, they're not more qualified. This nature of like kind of disappointment or sadness, even that we can attach to. I've spent a long time kind of wallowing. If you know the practice of the second arrow, I have a lot of like, why me? I got it from my family. And so, this like, oh, attachment to despair, to sadness, sometimes conscious or unconscious, we can attach to that, and then that leads to more suffering. And so all of these practices or Brahma Viharas invite us to cultivate again these conditions and these benevolent states. This is some part of why we practice. I think often of like my queer identity as a gay black man moving through the world, and how many challenges there have been because of my identity. Places where even in sanghas around practicing. So one of the first retreats I went to, I took the refuges. Excuse me, I took the you know what they are. I refrained from stealing. I refrained from intoxication. Starts with a P. Anybody? Precepts. Thank you, Caitlin. But taking the precepts, and then we get to this part where it's about like, oh, I agree to refrain from any sexual misconduct. And surprisingly, as a gay man moving through the world, like I had internalized that there was something wrong with my sexuality, that my inherent attraction was actually like, I refrained from sexual misconduct. And I had to be really clear, like, that's not misconduct. Although I had been kind of programmed and like had to really work to get myself free. And like, the practice isn't always pleasant, and it's certainly not easy. So for me to kind of decouple this way that I had unintentionally meshed sexual misconduct, like with my sexual identity, like to decouple that, it was really helpful to be able to have the practice to slow down, to move my attention with intention in that process. And so I think as queer folks, we also, these are practices are queer. So like I claim them, I've named them as such because they are integral to us. When you have to, many of us have had to kind of like share our identity in a way or come out. There's a real process by which you have to become real with yourself. And some of our practices within the Dharma, especially in Vipassana meditation, are integral and foundational to that. You have to kind of like look inward to be able to like understand your identity in enough way to like advocate or name it. This is my experience. I don't mean to have such broad strokes, but I wanted to like definitely share like a little bit of queer focus on there. Let's see. I'm just watching my time. This part about the practice isn't easy, right? Why do we practice? I can't believe it's 9 years ago almost, my mother passed away, and it's the worst thing that ever happened in my life. Although many of us experience loss of a pet or a loved one or a partner. I mean, it's just like, and I remember that my Irish Catholic aunts, like, oh, I'm so glad you have your practice. You can just zen out and not worry about how sad you feel. Excuse me, ma'am, what do you think the practice of meditation is? That is not it, right? We do practice, we do cultivate. I won't deny that my practice was helpful, but it was not to circumvent the suffering. Often our practice invites us to like meet it. I was painfully aware of the loss. I was like very deeply somatically impacted, and because of my mindful awareness, I was aware of how my body was reacting. I was in grief. And so our practice is not easy or soft. It can require us to meet the suffering in a different way. And I tell you this, 9 years later, I am stronger and I am clearer because I didn't hide from the suffering. I was able to meet it and let it land. I was tempted to distract, self-medicate. I was tempted in a lot of ways. And somehow my mindful awareness practice allowed me to be present enough to meet that moment. And so I just like point towards the ways in which our practice, if it's daily or weekly or even monthly, like you are building this muscle, and the practice is meant to create these conditions that can be supportive of these benevolent reflections. I did want to share a couple of readings, and then I'm gonna. Yep, that's my time. So the Four Noble Truths are, you know, basic and foundational pieces. The first noble truth is there is suffering for all beings, and that we will all experience it. The second is that there is a cause to that suffering, right? That we can consistently explore, like I mentioned, like our attachment to pleasant or our, you know, pushing away or of discomfort that those have suffering within themselves. And then there's this third noble truth, which is that there is an end to the suffering, right? And then the fourth is there's this Eightfold Path, which are wonderful guideposts that we can follow towards reducing the suffering. And I want to just read you a little bit about the third noble truth. And this is from the heart of the Buddha's teaching. It's a Thich Nhat Hanh text. It's an excellent one for foundational practices. He writes that the third noble truth is the cessation of creating suffering by refraining from doing things that make us suffer. This is good news. The Buddha did not deny the existence of suffering, but also did not deny the existence of joy and happiness. If you think that Buddhism says everything is suffering and we cannot do anything about it, that is the opposite of the Buddha's message. The Buddha taught us how to recognize and acknowledge the presence of suffering, but he also taught the cessation of suffering. If there were no possibility of the cessation, what would be the purpose of practicing? The third noble truth is that healing is possible. Simple and also powerful. Healing is possible. There is an end to the suffering. I once thought that, you know, I would ask people, why are you practicing? Do you believe that you will awaken, that you will achieve enlightenment in this lifetime? Maybe. But for those of us that maybe that isn't what we're thinking about, is it possible for the suffering to end even for a moment? You know, if I ask you to remember a moment when you have had maybe a moment of clarity or a moment, you know, in practice or not, where you felt like you understood patterns in life and how things worked and how things were aligned, if you had that moment where you're like, oh, yeah, I think I get it. It's a very grounding and like confident, like kind of lovely reveal. But what if that is the end of suffering? What if less than just a grand awakening or enlightenment? What if it's just like moments like that? And if we cultivate more of those moments of clarity or of alignment or of understanding through our practice, and we have those moments, you know, more often, like almost like a, put them on a, like a pearl or a necklace, like put them together. So instead of like having this grand awakening, what if the end of suffering is just kind of momentary and affirming, but like, but smaller instances of it? That's what I've been thinking about and trying to hold on to as I, yes, exactly. Just like the pearls get closer and closer together, the more of them you have. Yes. And you maybe have been practiced with Philip Moffitt at Spirit Rock. He wrote this incredible text that has a lot of wisdom in it from when my mother passed. It's called Dancing with Life, Buddhist Insights for Finding Meaning and Joy in the Face of Suffering. And I wanted to talk about kind of like the thing that I've been studying or working with recently a lot is a unique kind of suffering. This morning when I was speaking with my friend Renee, I was saying, you know, I just have this quality of dissatisfaction. I'm like, I'm not feeling burdened or like, I'm not feeling like I'm sad or depressed. I just feel like there's this kind of it's like a little bit of a glaze across things. And I'm like, I'm just feeling dissatisfied. Like it is dukkha, it is suffering, but it's not like my common one. And I was trying to explore and I was describing it as, you know, in the world, things are very difficult. I'm aware of suffering on a scale that I haven't known in my lifetime. And I'm aware of, you know, harm and cruelty that I can't reconcile in my mind. And that takes a toll throughout my day when I realize it. I also believe that I have fear around the conditions in the world, like environmental, political. I mean, like, and there's a fear that is low grade. It's not stopping me from getting out of bed in the morning, but it is in the back of my mind, and it's like pulling my attention. And it's creating an impact that I'm aware of. When I'm in my practice and I'm sitting, some of the thoughts that arise are like, what are you going to do when there's no food? What are you going to do when there's a real political difficult situation in this country and you don't feel safe? And so those things, I just want to point to that because what my friend Renee pointed to was like, I think that you're experiencing samsara. And so samsara is this concept that's like in the Buddhist tradition, we believe that there is reincarnation and that there's this cycle of life and death and life and death, and you move through it. And that you're kind of in this endless cycle until you can realize the limitation of it, right? You realize that there is a suffering, and as you become aware of it, it starts to fade. And so there's an awareness in this practice that we can notice and track. If I feel like there's a haze of suffering over some things that I can't quite put my finger on in my practice, I notice and I'm aware of it. That is how I begin to kind of engage with it and hopefully release it. So I'm not saying it skillfully. I'm just going to write. I'm going to read what Philip Moffitt said about it. He talked about three types of suffering. He says, I'm going to edit it. But the second type of suffering the Buddha described as virapama dukkha, dukkha that arises from anicca, or life's constantly changing nature. As you well know, there's never a moment when you can claim, now that's fixed forever. I do not have to worry about that anymore. Everything is in a perpetual state of flux, and therefore you are always guarding against things going wrong. Fixing what has already gone awry and trying to minimize how much things veer off course in the future. This is something I really associate with. He continues to write, the false promise that you can maintain control creates an expectation that the cause of suffering is itself, for you are bound to fail in this endeavor. Of course, you could act as wisely as possible to manage changes in your life. To do otherwise would be folly. But the difference lies in your attitude and expectations. Can you be at ease with this unpredictable, uncontrollable nature? Well, damn. I feel very seen and also very attacked. Can I? Can I meet the moment of unpredictable and uncontrollable nature of life? So I hope that this was not too heavy. My intention is to kind of like pose this as a question and to offer that in my experience, as I continue to practice and be in sangha and be in, places where I'm able to deepen my practice and grow, increasingly I move the needle towards maybe I can be. I can't say yes, but I can say that I am closer. The needle has shifted more than when I began. I think that it's like, it's not a zero-sum game. I am aware of my ability to kind of maintain and sustain this idea that I'm not attached to outcomes, invested in generating these benevolent states so that my life and the lives of every being on this planet are better. And that it's not a dream of genie moment, but it's more of a cultivated practice that allows us to deal with these very difficult questions. And so, as I bring my Dharma talk to a close, I invite you to reflect on your own practice and how it has maybe grown or how it has served you in difficult times. Is this concept of samsara, relevant to you? I encourage us to keep studying and to learn more together. I'm also curious if, this concepts around kind of the different kinds of suffering is relevant to you. How has your practice impacted? So we've got some time here. I intentionally carved out, some time for reflections. questions, feedback. I'm also love to hear different interpretations.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.